pendant of civilization. Above left, the Persian god Mithras sacrificing the bull. The sacrifice, also part of Dionysiac rites, can be seen as a symbol of the victory of man's spiritual nature over his animality, of which the bull is a common symbol. This may explain the popularity in some countries of bullfighting. Left. Right. An etching by Picasso, 1935, depicts a girl threatened by a minotaur. Here, as in the myth of Theseus, a symbol of man's uncontrollable instinctive forces. Both a bird and a shaman, that is, a primitive medicine man, are common symbols of transcendence, and often are combined. Left, a prehistoric cave painting at Lascaux, shows a shaman in a bird mask. Below, a shaman priestess of a Siberian people in a bird costume. Right, a shaman's coffin, also Siberian, with bird figures on the posts. In myths or dreams, a lonely journey often symbolizes the liberation of transcendence. Above left, a 15th century painting of the poet Dante holding his book, The Divine Comedy, which relates his dream of a journey to hell, lower left of picture, purgatory, and heaven. Far left, an engraving of the journey made by the pilgrim in the British author John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, 1678. Note that the journey is a circular movement toward an inner center. This book, too, is told as a dream. Left, the pilgrim dreaming. Many people want some change from a containing pattern of life, but the freedom gained by travel, urged by the runaway to sea poster, right, is no substitute for a true inner liberation. Left, the British explorer R. F. Scott and his companions, photographed in the Antarctic in 1911. Explorers, venturing into the unknown, provide an apt image of the liberation, the breaking out of containment that characterizes transcendence. The symbol of the snake is commonly linked with transcendence because it was traditionally a creature of the underworld and thus was a mediator between one way of life and another. Right, the snake and staff symbol of the Greco-Roman god of medicine, Asclepius, on a card used to identify a doctor's car in modern France. Left, a 17th century French painting reveals the snake's role as mediator between this world and the next. Orpheus is playing his lyre. He and his audience fail to notice that Eurydice, center of picture, has been bitten by a snake, a fatal wound that symbolizes her descent into the underworld. Above, the Egyptian god Thoth, with the head of a bird, an ibis, in a relief from circa 350 BC. Thoth is an underworld figure associated with transcendence. It was he who judged the souls of the dead. The Greek god Hermes, who was called Psychopomp, soul guide, had the function of guiding the dead to the underworld. Left, a stone Herm, which was placed at crossroads, symbolizing the god's role as a mediator between two worlds. On the side of the Herm is a snake twined around a staff. This symbol, the caduceus, was carried over to the Roman god Mercury, right, a 16th century Italian bronze, who also acquired wings, recalling the bird as a symbol of spiritual transcendence. Winged dragons, above, from a 15th century manuscript, combine the transcendent symbolism of the snake and the bird. Right, an image of spiritual transcendence. Muhammad, on the winged mare Burak, flies through the celestial spheres. In the dreams and fantasies of many modern people, the flights of the great rockets of space research have often appeared as symbolic 20th century embodiments of the urge toward liberation and release that is called transcendence. End of photo captions. Part 3. The Process of Individuation by M. L. von Franz. The Pattern of Psychic Growth. At the beginning of this book, Dr. C. G. Jung introduced the reader to the concept of the unconscious, its personal and collective structures, and its symbolic mode of expression. Once one has seen the vital importance, that is, the healing or destructive impact of the symbols produced by the unconscious, there remains the difficult problem of interpretation. Dr. Jung has shown that everything depends on whether any particular interpretation clicks and is meaningful to the individual concerned. In this way, he has indicated the possible meaning and function of dream symbolism. But in the development of Jung's theory, this possibility raised another question. What is the purpose of the total dream life of the individual? What role do dreams play, not only in the immediate psychic economy of the human being, but in his life as a whole? By observing a great many people and studying their dreams, he estimated that he interpreted at least 80,000 dreams, Jung discovered not only that all dreams are relevant in varying degrees to the life of the dreamer, but that they are all parts of one great web of psychological factors. He also found that on the whole they seem to follow an arrangement or pattern. This pattern Jung called the process of individuation. Since dreams produce different scenes and images every night, people who are not careful observers will probably be unaware of any pattern. But if one watches one's own dreams over a period of years and studies the entire sequence, one will see that certain contents emerge, disappear, and then turn up again. Many people even dream repeatedly of the same figures, landscapes, or situations, and if one follows these through a whole series, one will see that they change slowly but perceptibly. These changes can be accelerated if the dreamer's conscious attitude is influenced by appropriate interpretation of the dreams and their symbolic contents. Thus, our dream life creates a meandering pattern in which individual strands or tendencies become visible, then vanish, then return again. If one watches this meandering design over a long period of time, one can observe a sort of hidden regulating or directing tendency at work, creating a slow, imperceptible process of psychic growth, the process of individuation. Gradually, a wider and more mature personality emerges, and by degrees becomes effective and even visible to others. The fact that we often speak of arrested development shows that we assume that such a process of growth and maturation is possible with every individual. Since this psychic growth cannot be brought about by a conscious effort of willpower, but happens involuntarily and naturally, it is in dreams frequently symbolized by the tree, whose slow, powerful, involuntary growth fulfills a definite pattern. The organizing center from which the regulatory effect stems seems to be a sort of nuclear atom in our psychic system. One could also call it the inventor, organizer, and source of dream images. Jung called this center the self and described it as the totality of the whole psyche in order to distinguish it from the ego, which constitutes only a small part of the total psyche. Throughout the ages, men have been intuitively aware of the existence of such an inner center. The Greeks called it man's inner daimon. In Egypt, it was expressed by the concept of the ba-soul, and the Romans worshipped it as the genius native to each individual. In more primitive societies, it was often thought of as a protective spirit embodied within an animal or a fetish. This inner center is realized in exceptionally pure, unspoiled form by the Naskapi Indians, who still exist in the forests of the Labrador Peninsula. These simple people are hunters who live in isolated family groups so far from one another that they have not been able to evolve tribal customs or collective religious beliefs and ceremonies. In his lifelong solitude, the Naskapi hunter has to rely on his own inner voices and unconscious revelations. He has no religious teachers who tell him what he should believe, no rituals, festivals, or customs to help him along. In his basic view of life, the soul of man is simply an inner companion whom he calls my friend or Mr. Pio, meaning great man. Mr. Pio dwells in the heart and is immortal. In the moment of death or shortly before, he leaves the individual and later reincarnates himself in another being. Those Naskapi who pay attention to their dreams and who try to find their meaning and test their truth can enter into a deeper connection with the great man. He favors such people and sends them more and better dreams. Thus, the major obligation of an individual Naskapi is to follow the instructions given by his dreams and then to give permanent form to their contents in art. Lies and dishonesty drive the great man away from one's inner realm, whereas generosity and love of one's neighbors and of animals attract him, and give him life. Dreams give the Naskapi complete ability to find his way in life, not only in the inner world, but also in the outer world of nature. They help him to foretell the weather and give him invaluable guidance in his hunting, upon which his life depends. I mention these very primitive people because they are uncontaminated by our civilized ideas and still have natural insight into the essence of what Jung calls the self. The self can be defined as an inner guiding factor that is different from the conscious personality and that can be grasped only through the investigation of one's own dreams. These show it to be the regulating center that brings about a constant extension and maturing of the personality. But this larger, more nearly total aspect of the psyche appears first as merely an inborn possibility. It may emerge very slightly, or it may develop relatively completely during one's lifetime. How far it develops depends on whether or not the ego is willing to listen to the messages of the self. Just as the Naskapi have noticed that a person who is receptive to the hints of the great man gets better and more helpful dreams, we could add that the inborn great man becomes more real within the receptive person than in those who neglect him. Such a person also becomes a more complete human being. It even seems as if the ego has not been produced by nature to follow its own arbitrary impulses to an unlimited extent, but to help to make real the totality, the whole psyche. It is the ego that serves to light up the entire system, allowing it to become conscious and thus to be realized. If, for example, I have an artistic talent of which my ego is not conscious, nothing will happen to it. The gift may as well be non-existent. Only if my ego notices it can I bring it into reality. The inborn but hidden totality of the psyche is not the same thing as a wholeness that is fully realized and lived. One could picture this in the following way. The seed of a mountain pine contains the whole future tree in a latent form, but each seed falls at a certain time onto a particular place in which there are a number of special factors, such as the quality of the soil and the stones, the slope of the land, and its exposure to sun and wind. The latent totality of the pine in the seed reacts to these circumstances by avoiding the stones and inclining toward the sun, with the result that the tree's growth is shaped. Thus, an individual pine slowly comes into existence, constituting the fulfillment of its totality, its emergence into the realm of reality. Without the living tree, the image of the pine is only a possibility or an abstract idea. Again, the realization of this uniqueness in the individual man is the goal of the process of individuation. From one point of view, this process takes place in man, as well as in every other living being, by itself and in the unconscious. It is a process by which man lives out his innate human nature. Strictly speaking, however, the process of individuation is real only if the individual is aware of it and consequently makes a living connection with it. We do not know whether the pine tree is aware of its own growth, whether it enjoys and suffers the different vicissitudes that shape it, but man certainly is able to participate consciously in his development. He even feels that from time to time, by making free decisions, he can cooperate actively with it. This cooperation belongs to the process of individuation in the narrower sense of the word. Man, however, experiences something that is not contained in our metaphor of the pine tree. The individuation process is more than a coming to terms between the inborn germ of wholeness and the outer acts of fate. Its subjective experience conveys the feeling that some suprapersonal force is actively interfering in a creative way. One sometimes feels that the unconscious is leading the way in accordance with a secret design. It is as if something is looking at me, something that I do not see, but that sees me, perhaps that great man in the heart, who tells me his opinions about me by means of dreams. But this creatively active aspect of the psychic nucleus can come into play only when the ego gets rid of all purposive and wishful aims and tries to get to a deeper, more basic form of existence. The ego must be able to listen attentively and to give itself, without any further design or purpose, to that inner urge toward growth. Many existentialist philosophers try to describe this state, but they go only as far as stripping off the illusions of consciousness. They go right up to the door of the unconscious and then fail to open it. People living in cultures more securely rooted than our own have less trouble in understanding that it is necessary to give up the utilitarian attitude of conscious planning in order to make way for the inner growth of the personality. I once met an elderly lady who had not achieved much in her life, in terms of outward achievement, but she had in fact made a good marriage with a difficult husband, and had somehow developed into a mature personality. When she complained to me that she had not done anything in her life, I told her a story related by a Chinese sage, Zhuang Zhu. She understood immediately and felt great relief. This is the story. A wandering carpenter called Stone saw on his travels a gigantic old oak tree standing in a field near an earth altar. The carpenter said to his apprentice, who was admiring the oak, "This is a useless tree. If you wanted to make a ship, it would soon rot. If you wanted to make tools, they would break. You can't do anything useful with this tree, and that's why it has become so old." But in an inn, that same evening, when the carpenter went to sleep, the old oak tree appeared to him in his dream and said, "Why do you compare me to your cultivated trees, such as whitethorn, pear, orange, and apple trees, and all the others that bear fruit? Even before they can ripen their fruit, people attack and violate them. Their branches are broken, their twigs are torn. Their own gifts bring harm to them, and they cannot live out their natural span. That is what happens everywhere, and that is why I have long since tried to become completely useless. You poor mortal. Imagine, if I had been useful in any way, would I have reached this size? Furthermore, you and I are both creatures, and how can one creature set himself so high as to judge another creature? You useless mortal man, what do you know about useless trees?" The carpenter woke up and meditated upon his dream, and later, when his apprentice asked him why just this one tree served to protect the earth altar, he answered, "Keep your mouth shut. Let's hear no more about it. The tree grew here on purpose, because anywhere else people would have ill-treated it. If it were not the tree of the earth altar, it might have been chopped down." The carpenter obviously understood his dream. He saw that simply to fulfill one's destiny is the greatest human achievement, and that our utilitarian notions have to give way in the face of the demands of our unconscious psyche. If we translate this metaphor into psychological language, the tree symbolizes the process of individuation, giving a lesson to our short-sighted ego. Under the tree that fulfilled its destiny, there was, in Zhuang Zhu's story, an earth altar. This was a crude, unwrought stone upon which people made sacrifices to the local god who owned this piece of land.